Last week, we released the first part of a two-part episode.
The billions of dollars that go to Hamas, to UNRWA, and all these other organizations, we are funding global jihad, but we say we are against it.
If you haven't heard the first part of our discussion, you can find it on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Hope you enjoy. We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
And here I am. We shall never die.
First 4.5 chapters, the initial work is done. Why did he come back from Persia? To oversee the rebuilding of the wall. It was the national security for Judah, for Jerusalem. But the rest of the time he spends dealing with government corruption. What is he dealing with? He's dealing with priests who are working with the Ammonites and the other people who are enemies of Israel. They're renting out parsonages or renting out, the people are living in these things for money. There's a whole racket that's going on. He's dealing with the people who are the governors, the quadruple taxes that people are paying, right? And again, this is not, so these are Jewish leaders who are very much in power, and the Jewish middle class, working class, they're really, really struggling. So you have a class warfare thing going on that's no longer about the outside, it's within the Jewish framework, right? And the point I'm making is this. Once he starts to deal with the other more salient issue, that's when his life was in danger. There were assassination attempts on him. They started a whole slander campaign. The prophets began to say all kinds of mean, nasty, evil things about him because he was over the target. As long as he was dealing with Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs, that was cool. But once he began to deal with, hey, you're a rabbi, blah, 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 and now again, for people listening, this is not a Jewish thing. I'm not making it about against Jews. I'm saying black communities. One thing, I'm dealing with racism and da, 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 da. But now I'm in the community and I'm dealing with this guy who's been an alderman for the last 30 years, who's full of crap. He's been getting money from the same people that he said are the bad people, but somehow he's getting kickbacks and he's on the foot. His foot is on my neck just as much as the white racist. Why? Because he needs me to continue to struggle so that I can blame white people. The Palestinians do that to their people all the time, right? We want to enter the occupation. Mahmoud Abbas's house is worth $12 million in Judea and Samaria. He won't have no damn occupation. The occupation pays his bills. So he gets up and he says in Arabic, we want these people gone. In English, we want peace. We want to come together. And the people that he's taken advantage of, to your point, are the Palestinians of the West Bank. The people who are getting screwed over are the people in Gaza. Why? Because their leaders are millionaires and billionaires, and they need the conflict to keep going. And oh, by the way, who's paying for it? American taxpayer. That's the game. The game becomes everybody's getting their little piece of the pie, except for the people who are getting screwed over, right? So the people who, like a Nehemiah, stands up and he goes, wait a minute. This is wrong. They went, okay, got to get rid of this dude now. So that's kind of where we are right now.
Man, the parallels to, you know, the civil rights movement is so incredible because when did Martin Luther King get assassinated? When he started talking about, wait, it's not just race. Racism is the huge thing, but it's an economic thing.
Yes.
We're going to change that poor black and poor white people will all rise.
Yes.
All of a sudden, he becomes a national danger. And
absolutely. And then it was funny. I can't remember. What was it? Something in the Black Messiah. It was done on Hulu. And it was about, I can't remember the name right now. You guys forgive me. But he was one of the Black Panther leaders based in the Midwest somewhere. And the same thing. He began to galvanize the white community, black community, who are poor and disaffected, and how the system was grinding them like a meat grinder. And that's when he got dangerous. And he was actually taken out by the feds. So history has taught us that over and over again. And for the young people listening, they say, well, why should I be doing it if I'm going to get killed? No, you're going to get assassinated. I mean, yes.
You're not going to get killed. You're going to be on a podcast.
Yeah, basically, get to that. And you are going to catch heat. But what I always encourage young people to do is then to, in terms of the actual principle itself, don't just talk about justice. Really do the work. Really find out. And then work towards it, right? Either that or leave it alone. Don't play with it, right? Don't become part of the problem, right? Don't carve out your little niche in the thing and here's this big industry and say, I'm fighting against it, but I'm really not. I'm just going to get this much money to say blah, 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 right? So that becomes the thing. Yes, what will happen is, you'll ruffle feathers. You'll make some people pissed off. You will. But you will be on the right side of history if you're concerned about that. You will be speaking truth to power in that sense. And you will be I love that scripture in Isaiah, setting captives free, right? Their people are bound because systems that are there in place that are predicated on their suffering, right? Whether you're talking about Palestinians, about Sudanese who are dying because of their faith or that. So here you have people who are actually going through just crushing circumstances and situations that someone can do something about. Back to that whole Ta-Nehisi Coates people. I'm trying to beat up on him. I'm using him as an example. He was a young man who found out about, staunch injustices in college. And so was given that opportunity. God only knew what he was going to become. You're looking at that video. This is some gangly kid here in Howard. He goes on to become this huge force in the literary world and doesn't use it in a way that at least dealt with this particular issue. So what we point to these things, they would say, yes, and I try to be honest with you, even my own kids, yes, when you speak out, you're going to get pushback. Yeah, you're going to get, that's true, yes. It's the difference between lionizing those who've gone before us, whether biblically or whatever fields, whether it's Dr. King, whether it's a David, whether it's a Nehemiah, right? It's the difference between lionizing them and learning from them. I said the danger becomes, we talk about this as pastors, and danger is when we have our little Sunday school lessons, and we know, and this was David, and this was Samson. Oh, yeah. And so you make them almost like cartoon characters. Like, yeah, these people, and Samuel was one of the greatest prophets of Israel. And so, oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, but what can I glean from him? That was a long time ago. What is now? So if God gave him the strength and the wisdom and the Deborahs and the Esthers, and okay, so then what does that mean for me? Otherwise, you're just telling me stories I could watch Little Bill on TV, right? All you've done at that point was you've entertained me with some people who did some very courageous things. Great. But there's a lot of crap happening right now. There's some things that are broken now. What am I supposed to do? How do I'll never rise to the level of a Samuel or a David. Okay, fine. But in my little corner of the world, what am I supposed to do? I believe that among many other things, October 7th challenged people in that regard. Okay, but what do I do though? This was horrific. Now, what do I do? As an American who stands with Israel, right? What does that mean going forward, right? What did I learn from that, right? Would I just, oh, that's really bad. That's really terrible. Click, turn the TV, go do something else. Or is there something I'm supposed to do and be engaged? When I saw some of the videos of you standing for what you believed in and knowing that I'm watching the videos, I'm watching the stuff that you're being called and the whole thing, right? You're not here. You are a professor. You can't even have access to, what is this? Selma, Alabama, 1953. So this was actually going on, but you're doing it not because you want to be on somebody's stupid video. You could care less about that. You're doing it because you know it's the right thing to do. And you know, never met you before, you knew you were fighting not just for you, but for your child, for people coming behind you, because you laid down and took it. If you allowed whatever to happen, what in God's name was going to happen after you?
But I'll tell you a difference.
Yes, sir.
You and I are not 20. And if I were 20, yes, I don't think I would have the same poise and courage.
Yes, sir.
To stand up.
Yes, but you're arguing my point. That means the 20-year-olds who are watching you see it in real time. That's one of the most important things that I've learned. I may not get things all right. I may mess something up, but damn it, I better say something. And if that's the legacy I leave for my kids and my grandkids, then I've done my job. If they ask me, Grandpa, what did you do? I sat there and I pissed and moaned and made a Facebook post and I went and got a hamburger from, okay, so right. But what did you do, Grandpa, right? So that's my point. Young people have to see it in real time. Part of the reason why they're so jaded today, I don't care if they're Jewish young people, Muslim young people, Christian young people, we're seeing a crisis of faith in the West. And part of the reason, not the only reason, part of the reason they hear a lot of jawjacking and a lot of broken stuff. Stuff messed up all over the place, people running their mouths, politicians, pastors, preachers, rabbis, and they're looking at what's actually going on the ground, and they're saying, okay, I see a disconnect. I hear the rhetoric, but I don't see any change on the ground. Or I hear the rhetoric, and I see it partnering with the very oppression that they say is the problem. Part of what the young people are seeing is the BS. They're going, okay, but wait a minute, hold on, how come we're doing this? So right back to the Mahmoud Khalil, some people are watching him get shipped off, but they know what I know. They know the money's coming from Qatar, right? They're sitting there going, okay. So they, you know what they're saying? They're saying, okay, what's going to happen next? There are professors who are doing way worse than Mahmoud Khalil is doing, and they have tenure. Are we going to have a discussion about that? Are we going to actually talk about what's the professors who fly to Israel and they go to Ramallah and meet with the PFLP? No, we're not going to talk about that. Okay, but you're going to kick this kid out of the country, but you're not going to deal with the professors who are doing even worse than him. Young people are watching those things. They're aware of these things. So when they see a Shai or whoever doing something, okay, I may not do it like he's doing it. I mean, like, say it like she's saying it, but damn it, I could do something. I need to be able to do something. This is what we found. That's why I told that story about the Sudanese gentleman who were just those black students in Israel. They're sitting there in Jerusalem, and they're sitting there hearing all this, and he's going, I need your help. And they didn't see themselves as having that kind of agency. A couple of them came up to me after that lecture was done. They said, Pastor Musani, when I go back to my school, I'm going to start this whole campaign and make people aware. I said, there you go. Do something. I'm going to go back and tell these other young people what I heard in Israel and some things they need to be aware about. They saw a Sudan-Israel connection they had never seen before. Say, okay, I get it. That's to me, Dave, it's what we need to be doing. What we need to be doing is our part so that at least someone younger can glean from that and say, okay, boom.
I love you keep going back to agency, and I think agency is so extremely important. You know, even in the story of Exodus from Egypt.
Yes.
You know, and it's, I'm not a believer, but you know, the story is where God saved the Israelites.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, but they started walking. He didn't come and take them from their home. Like, first, you got to mark your home so the angel of death doesn't come to you.
100%.
And second, you got to pack up, you got to make your bread, and you got to leave. Then I'll help you.
100%. What I love about the stories, what I love about the principles that are there, just like you outlined it, that God would always make me do something, right? Oh, God's going to deliver. No, but I'm supposed to, right? So whether it was that, I was thinking about, we're watching this series about David and Goliath on Amazon. This is a new thing. My wife and I have been watching it together. And it's funny, he's anointed king, but there's already a king. That's just, from the time I read that when I was a little kid, it's like, God, you're not fair at all, right? So this is sedition, right? This is like, you're trying to overthrow a government. And Samuel even talking to God's like going, what? Yeah, go anoint this guy, go to Bethlehem.
You promised me, what's happening here?
Yeah. Right, so then Saul's the king, and he's already pissed off at everybody. Now, of course, my life is in danger. And he does it in a way that makes us partner, to your point. So it's not a matter I just sit on the couch and kind of pray my prayers and, you know, read my little scriptures. And no, you go, okay, so now that's great, wonderful for you. Now what are you going to do? Rabbi Heschel said that he felt that up until that point, when he's marching in Selma, he said that it was never as real as it was then. He said, I felt like our feet were praying. For him, I'm fighting for justice. This is a tangible thing for me. I'm standing with my black brothers and sisters. They are being completely disenfranchised. I'm now taking all of my experience, my knowledge, my wisdom as a rabbi, and I'm out here trying to make this. He did it with all the humility of, you know, he didn't call himself Superman. He's just going, look, I'm trying to make this difference, and I'm taking a direct application to these biblical principles that I teach, and I'm bringing them out here in the streets. Literally out here, I'm trying to make this happen. That's always an admirable thing, but to the beginning of our conversation, once I've done the work and I understand what's going on, because people will try to twist that into something else, right? Defining justice as destroying Israel, for example, right? So once I've done the work and I understand what it is that's at play, and I've hopefully understood what my role should be in fighting against this injustice, then that becomes a very, very powerful moment. Now, again, not just for me, but for people that are watching, somebody that's listening. Often when we do our events across the country, I tell people they'll see stuff on social media. I said, we recognize social media is one thing and the real world is a different thing. We'll be in different cities and there'll be black leaders, others who will come to the event that we're at, and they'll say, you don't know me? I've been following you for the last 2-3 years. Thank you so much. I didn't know how to articulate it, and I've been taking this information back. That's always warms our heart. We were at a Harlem cafe about a year ago, my son and I. We did an event there. It's actually go to Zion Cafe. It's actually Ethiopian Israeli. Yeah. Yes, sir. We were there, had a great time, and then several people had come. One was a young African-American young lady, came and talked with my son, gave him that same story. She said, I've listened to the Mark Lamont Hills and other people who are very, very anti-Israel. And she said, I didn't really know how to push back. I started following you all. I found you on social media. I started following you. And now I have a better understanding, not just with the Israel thing, but as a black woman, why these issues are so important. We hear those types of things across the country all the time. And it does our hearts good. And my point being, we would have never have known them. You don't know. When you're fighting like that, people are watching. You don't always know who they are. As a matter of fact, sometimes people are saying mean, nasty stuff to you at that one moment. A little bit later on, may feel a different sort of way. One last story. So then I was
kill me a million stories. I'm listening, man.
I was in UNC Charlotte. I was speaking there at an event, and the SJP chapter came to protest, you know, the whole thing. And they came with their banners and
protesting you?
Yeah, protesting me for the speech I was bringing. It was a pro-Israel, kind of Dr. King, pro-Israel speech, everything like that. So they saw what it was. They saw the flyer. They came. Along with professors and students, they came. Banners. That's like, I don't care who's in there as long as you don't disrupt. You know, you can sit there. You can hold your sign. You know, do anything to me. Right? So we had long, did lecture and everything like that, did some Q&A and everything. And then when it was over, there was a young man there. I could tell he was of Arab descent, but I didn't know where he was from. I think he was from Morocco. He's Arab Muslim. And he said, I came because I wanted to hear what you had to say. He said, when I saw the SJP group over there, they wanted me to stand with them. They just did the whole racial profiling thing. You come stand with us. He said, I don't want to have anything to do with them. He said, because I didn't come for that. I didn't come to protest. I came to just to listen. I came to objectively listen. And I want to thank you for coming. You told me a lot of stuff I did not know. I did not realize. I did not understand. Thank you for coming. That's when he said, I'm doing a criminal justice major and everything. See, for me, he wasn't a Zionist. He wasn't anti-Zionist, but he was there to hear. So he came and he listened and he learned and he said, I'm going to apply these things to what I'm doing, what I'm studying and everything. Those moments are very, very, very important to me. Because here I am out here putting myself out here, yeah. But it's for young people like that, that he's like going, I didn't know this, and he would have never heard it. Unless somebody who was Black who knew these things like I knew them, right? And I'm not the only person, I'm saying unless they were going to be able to bring that to him and explain, here's the PLO connection, here's the whole Dr. King here, here's how they manipulate the Black community. So he's sitting there listening to it, as an Arab Muslim kid from Morocco sitting there going, he's going, huh. I never saw that connection before. I didn't realize that before. He learned a lot from that thing. To me, that's an empowering thing. They learned something they didn't learn. They wouldn't have learned, but someone had to be willing to get up and do that. So deliverance, like you said, to your redemption, comes from us walking, moving, doing it in a way that we're supposed to do.
Yeah, you know, I've been traveling around for 17 months around the country, the world, basically, trying to organize people and push this idea that I call everyday activism. Mm. Every day you wake up and you say, what am I doing today? And every night you go to sleep and say, what did I do today? And you don't have to go and change the world, but you got to do something. And I tell people this story about throwing pebbles into a lake. Mm. You know, you throw pebbles into a lake, which is you know, I don't know why, but it's something that every person does when they see rocks and water.
Yes.
And you get ripples, and some ripples die out immediately. Some of them actually grow and become waves. You have no idea which pebble will make a wave.
Exactly.
All you have control over is throwing the pebble. Yes. And I tell people, just keep throwing.
Yes.
That's all you have to do. Yes. You're not defined by the consequences or the outcomes. You're defined by the action.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. 100%. I was in a meeting before I was here a couple weeks ago. I was in San Diego and had a meeting with some leaders. But that same issue came up because we were talking about how dire things are, how difficult they are, right? And one of the leaders asked me, well, why do we fight if it's hopeless? I said, no, I'm not saying it's hopeless. I said, don't mistake my being blunt for being discouraged, right? I get it. It's really a lot of bad stuff happening. But to your point, I said, they said that we need a critical mass. I said, critical mass comes from the beginning. Something has to start, right? So that's why we keep doing. We keep pushing. I have this idea. I said, well, let's try everything, right? Start that initiative. Because like you said, we don't know which might be the thing. Something might be something that sparks something, that the people understand and know what's going on. We are fighting in our nation for this nation. The hatred for Israel and the Jewish people is a tool that the enemies of this nation is using to destroy the nation, right? Joseph Stalin, he was the one who started the whole anti-Israel, anti-Zionist thing got completely retrofitted under him. He started the entire Jews, the protocols of the Elder Zion, meaning that the Jews somehow control the Senate and control the Western world, all that stuff. That stuff, like never before, got ramped up under him because of his fear that NATO was a force he was never going to be able to defeat. And he was right. When he saw the United States and the Western European powers coalesce together post-World War II, and the Soviet Union is trying to fight up against, he said, there's no way, we can't. So I read in the book Disinformation, the former KGB agent talked about it. He says, what can we do? How do we destroy them from the inside? You know what? Jew hatred. It's the oldest hatred in the world. If we get the Westerners fighting about the Jews who are controlling, and the Jews, then we can weaken them. That was always the goal. The Islamist thing came later on because it's the same goal, destroy America, but from a different perspective. So that then becomes what we're dealing with now. They're trying to destroy our country. They're trying to destroy freedom. And again, as flawed, our country's no more perfect than anywhere else, but that's the same thing can be said about Israel, right? But you want to see what it looks like without Israel there? Are you kidding me right now? Israel, first of all, is always going to be there. But why are they trying to destroy it? Because they hate Jews? Absolutely, right? Because they don't want a Jewish state there? Absolutely. But what do they want? They want a despotism, right? You have Jews, Christians, and Muslims coming together, fighting against the type of slaughter that's going on in different parts of the world. Why? Because they see the ones who fled places like Nigeria and Sudan, they get it. This is not a pipe dream. They get what this looks like. They're going, you don't want, so they get to the United States and then they see what's going on campuses. It scares the crap out of them. Cause they're going, we know what the end game is here. And this is not, so they watch a place like Syria. The African Jewish Alliance, David Shai, was started right after October the 7th by people in Nigeria and Sudan who, when they saw the images coming about October 7th, they said, that happens to us every week. They saw what Hamas was. They saw the trucks. They saw the, and they said, yep, Boko Haram does that every week. Al-Shabaab does that over in Kenya every week. So they said, we're standing with our Jewish brothers and sisters like never before because we're all fighting against the same thing. So when they see what's going on here in the West and they see the type of fight on our college campuses, what's going on our streets, it frightens them because we are supposed to be a place where there's freedom, freedom of religion, freedom of thought. So when they're seeing that type of despotism encroaching here, yeah, they get concerned. And we as Americans should be concerned. So that's why I said it's everyone's fight, whether they realize it or not, right? Yeah. It's everyone's fight. So,
and yeah. But there's one other thing here that I think is worth mentioning. There's a broader trend here. In 2010, 2011, you had people concerned about economic inequality, which is a huge problem. And mm-hmm. before doing this, that's what my research was about. That turned into a movement, Occupy Wall Street, which had completely different goals. Yes, sir. 2020, you had a movement that started with the horrific murder of George Floyd and talking about racism and systemic racism and issues that are extremely important. That turned into something completely different and militant.
Yes.
2023-24, you have a movement that starts with we don't want killing, we want right. peace, we want, you know, right. war is bad, right. and it turns into right. destroy Israel. What's happening? How are these movements, you know, taking a good idea, a noble idea,
right.
grabbing a lot of, you yes. know, good Americans that just want to help,
yes. Yes.
turning it into something else?
Much of that, there's more than one, but I'll just, in the interest of time, point to, again, the origin of the propaganda war against Israel in that way, particularly in the 60s. So what became social capital, or what became any type of authenticity when it came to social justice issues, fell into certain categories. Now, again, we're talking 2025 now, but we're talking about something that started decades ago, meaning that if you were truly concerned about any of those things that you mentioned, by now, then you are necessarily anti-Zionist. Now, that was not the case in the 60s. Just the case was being made then, right? You're against racial oppression, systemic racism, economic oppression, any of the things that you just mentioned there, right? That then you being on the right side of history, you have to recognize then that Israel is a settler, colonial, occupying, imperialist power. Again, none of those things are true. But once I've made that case, it fits into that slot. Therefore, when you're talking about something that happens post-October 7th and people should be up in arms about the raping of women and the kidnapping of children, it doesn't happen that way because Israel already by default is guilty of those things. Therefore, what just happened to Israel is what Israel has been, quote unquote, doing. As sadistic as it sounds, that's where we are. That's why the same people don't care about Syria, don't care about Iraq, don't care about Nigeria. They have been conditioned to see that in the context of Israel. If Israelis aren't involved, they say no Jews, no news. There's a certain amount of truth to that little quip because there that has been what has set the tone. So many Jewish friends were part of the Black Lives Matter protests after George Floyd. George Floyd, Black Lives Matter, which actually was born in 2013. It was much older than 2020, but 2020 became a huge flashpoint. And when they saw people turning on them, while they were there marching, it hit them again. But this happened during the Women's March, did it not? Same thing, right? They're women's rights. Next thing you know, Linda Sarsour becomes one of the keynote speakers. And Jewish friends are going, wait, what's going on? Because the die had already been cast. Meaning, because it was a social justice issue, it was an anti-Zionist issue. Even when Colin Kaepernick with the whole San Francisco 49ers and the whole kneeling and everything, he not him particularly, but what started to happen, Linda Sarsour was part of that camp. They get up one of their speeches about the Zionists. The Zionists are the reason why I'm not making more money, or the Zionists are the reason why I'm having to kneel. Those types of things, all this conflation, it has already been set. So, Shai, what we have to realize is that because that has already been set, that doesn't mean we don't fight for things that are right. It just means we have to be vigilant about it. So for years, I've had conversations with Jewish friends who are part of the different groups who themselves were then ostracized for no other reason than being Jewish. Regardless of what their view on Israel was, right? They could have been as anti-Zionist as anybody else, right? They usually weren't. But even if they were, they found that it didn't make any difference. They were Jewish and then guilty by default. It's one of the most dangerous things that's happened here in our country because we now have associated a Jewish person, even if he's never set foot in Israel, right? Doesn't know anything about the conflict. We've associated, we've demonized him based on the demonization of Israel. When they used to say anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, people would get cynical, say it's not true. It's always been true, but it's never been more true now. So here we have these same issues where you're fighting for whatever that issue is that may be education, economics. And unfortunately, for some, the entrance of a Jewish person or even Israel as a conversation gets lumped in there. So for those who are confused, let me give you an example. George Floyd kneeling on the neck, and what happens? Black Lives Matter and Jewish Voice for Peace, they come together and they say, the reason why there's racist cops is because Israel trains police. Why? After 9/11, yes, Israel, the best at counterterrorism, actually helps train other police officers. That has nothing to do with what a racist cop does. But in their mind, it does, and that's what actually got happened. So the whole defund the police issue, that came after what was called the Deadly Exchange. Deadly Exchange was what preceded defund the police. And Deadly Exchange said this, because Israel helps train police, Israel is responsible when a white officer kills an unarmed black man because Israelis are racist. Remember, that slot is already there. Now I'm just filling something else with that slot. And many people begin to, Durham, North Carolina, they stopped their training with the Israeli police. They tried to get Atlanta to do it, but Kasim Reed, I believe was the mayor at the time, he wouldn't budge. He's very, very much pro-Israel. He's like going, you know what? I'm not doing that. Black Lives Matter tried to petition him to sever their relationship with the Israeli police. He said, nope, they happen to be the best at what they do, and we're going to continue to train. Those are best practices for us. But that's the pressure that was coming on city councils across the country. Oakland City Council passed a resolution calling for a ceasefire. Chicago, ceasefire. Wait a minute, that's 8,000 miles away. You have issues in your city, issues that need to be addressed there that have nothing to do with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, yet you come together to write a resolution about Israel. That's where we are. That wasn't the case in the 60s and 70s. But that is where we are now. So that, I'm hoping, it underscores the fight that we're in right now, right?
It's very grim.
Yes.
At the same time, I always try to focus on what can be done. And you talked about the conditioning.
Yes, sir.
You've been part of the unconditioning process. You're trying to unravel this way of thinking. So tell me about your book, Zionism and the Black Church.
So Zionism and the Black Church.
And by the way, I have to ask,
yeah,
as a Jew looking from the outside, why do you say the Black Church and not Zionism and the Church?
I spend the first several chapters in my introduction discussing that very thing. And what I tell them is that the church, we're talking about the universal church, because Christians are all over the world, different ethnicities, that there's not a, it's not a discriminatory thing, but it's a legacy thing, like I said before. That we say Black church, we're talking about a specific narrative of slavery to freedom, these Black American descendants of slaves who had a specific type of Christian ethos passed down to them from generation to generation, which is seen as stuff like the Negro spirituals and the different teachings and the preachings that would be parallel to what was what we were going through. So these are the things that I mean when I say Black church, not say there's not white Christians and Hispanic Christians and everything, but that specific thing, that thing, like I told you before, I told you Lift Every Voice and Sing was a very Zionist psalm. That song was written to the descendants. That song was written to me and to my children. It was telling us to remember the God who brought you out of Egypt. It's very, very explicit in the song in terms of what the meaning is and what we are supposed to be remembering as Black Americans who've gone through all these different things. So that's the meaning of the book. I'm talking to the people who've come from that legacy or talking to that legacy and then out to everybody else. So I explain that in the book. I'm saying Black church, that particular ethos, which is why I deal a lot of scripture and a lot of history. We do history, we do music, we do all kinds of different things to tie those things in together. Quick example, Lauryn Hill in the 1990s, her hip-hop album, Miseducation, Lauryn Hill, it's Jerusalem and Zion all over the thing. Her son was named Zion, right? So we're saying, why was this young Black woman writing about Zion like this? Because it's part of the Black tradition. She was doing something that's been going on for centuries. Even some of the songs that she sampled in there were old songs we've been singing in church for generations, right? But if you didn't know that, you thought she just kind of came up with it. No, we're marching to Zion, beautiful, beautiful Zion. Those are old, ancient songs, right? So she's then embodying this whole Zionism. She's not a, you know, political Zionist. She even became this very pro-Palestinian. But I'm saying she was still saying something that came from a tradition that we all descended from. Hope that makes sense there.
Yeah.
So the book speaks to that, David. It goes through different chapters in terms of, we start with the African connection to Israel. We talk about the fact that Sinai is in Egypt. All this happened before, right? The 3,000-year by now story about the Queen of Sheba visiting Solomon in Jerusalem, right? These are not happenstance. We talk about these stories, what these actual stories, what they meant, how when she traveled there, she stood next to Solomon in solidarity with the Jewish people. God loves Israel forever. Why is this African queen traveling all the way to Jerusalem to meet with this Jewish king? And we talk about why. We talk about what David actually said about that visit before it actually happened. All these things, right? So we talk about why these things are important, what they've actually meant to both Black Americans and other Africans in the diaspora. Why Zionism has been so fused with who we are as a people. And we talk about the modern day application, we talk about the college campuses. We talk about one of the reasons why you can recognize the importance is by Israel's enemies. Right now, as we sit, the mullahs of Iran are recruiting young Black Americans and Africans to become Shia clerics. They take them to Tehran for 7-8 years, and they send them back to their communities to preach that very specific radical Shia Islam. And my question is, why? Why are they singling out Black young people? Because of that same ethos. Because they know if these Black young men get up and they say these things, people will listen to them. This is still happening right now as we speak, right? So we talk about these things in the book. We actually, not about that specific thing, but we talk about Iran's involvement in this, in a sense. And the book then gives a lot of history and a lot of information. And then the last chapter deals with what we do from here. Now that we have all this information, what's happened, Booker T. Washington, Julius Rosenwald, Rosenwald schools, and what that actually meant before you even got to the Civil Rights Movement, before Dr. King was even born, you had this Jewish and Black alliances helping build education in our nation, right? So we have all that conversation and we talk about how we move from here based on all these things that have come before us. What do we do now? And the future is bright. I'll tell you, I'm concerned about the Western world. We talk about the future, meaning the problems are very, very systemic. We're going to have to address those. Hatred for Israel, hatred for the Jewish people. That's great. Even in the United States, left and right, you're seeing the—
I'll say even more, hatred in general is systemic, and we need to, for any group, it needs to be eradicated. And,
but the Jewish people, which is the oldest hatred, except that Stalin used it, is then used to destroy everything else around it, because we know that what starts with our Jewish friends never ends there. So we talk about all these things in the book, and we give some practical solutions to what we do as Black pastors and rabbis as we come together. What do we do in our communities? How we do that together? I'll be in Israel at the end of May at an African Jewish, African Israel conference. that's there that we're helping plan. I'll be in Ethiopia at the beginning of May for the Ethiopian pastors and leaders there. What's called the Let My People Go conference. They planned it. I've been there before, but they've asked me to come speak because you have Africans more and more embracing their ties to Israel, not just spiritually, but also in a practical way. So we talk about these things in the book in terms of how we approach them, why they're so important, why there's such a responsibility on Black leaders to help set this tone like never before.
And so I just want to, for the audience, Zionism in the Black Church.
Yes, sir.
It was published.
The latest one was 2021. The second edition is February 2021.
2021.
Yes, sir.
Before we end, I actually want to ask you a little bit about Olga.
Yes. Yes, sir. I'm just going
to know, who was, I never got to meet Olga. It's your daughter-in-law, yes, Olga Michelle Washington.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And she recently passed away. Tell me about Olga.
It's interesting. When I leave here.
She's married to your son.
Yes, that's my daughter-in-law. Married to my son. I have six children, one son, five daughters. So that was my only daughter-in-law. We considered her our sixth daughter. Beautiful young lady. And it is still very hard for us. This is actually only the second trip that I've taken. She passed away on January the 6th. And we had lots of stuff planned for the first quarter, but everything shut down. And so my first trip was a couple of weeks ago to San Diego. I did some events there, then in Texas, and now here on the East Coast, back to the East Coast. Olga, she's an amazing individual, only 43 years old. She's the mother of our first two grandsons. Her father, Kenneth Mushwe, we're having Kenneth Mushwe, is a parliament member in South Africa, and also started a PROIS organization, a Black South African PROIS organization in 2013, the exact same year we started ours. We just didn't know each other. It just happened, boom, one of those things. And that's how our children met each other, my son, his daughter. They met doing Israel-Africa work, right? And fell in love, and eventually, of course, got married and everything. And there's a hole in our hearts. My son, for those who are asking, thank you for your prayers and everything. It's day to day. His sons give him life. The grandsons are 6 and 4. It's a very, very difficult time. I'm very grateful for our family because we're really close-knit. We're a big family, but we're close-knit. And we've really leaned on each other. So I've watched my son with his sisters, the boys, aunties, and our close friends in the family. And he's drawn strength from there. It's difficult. It's only been, 3 months now? Not even 3 months. And it's still very raw.
Yeah.
I know that he eventually will be fine and everything, but I tell my son himself, I say to him often, Shai, as your father, obviously there's a lot of things I've experienced that you haven't, but I've never experienced this. I have not lost a spouse. I said, so son, you're in uncharted territory for me, but just know that we're here. And how much I admired him. I'm watching only what I could imagine him going through, but I'm watching him do it with a grace and a love. His boys, I told them this, I'll say this last thing. I'm watching them. They live not too far from where, about 20 minutes from where we live. So they're part of the week there at our house, and then at his house, they little camp out. And I'm watching my grandsons who miss their mom, right? But laugh, play, right? They'll ride our bikes, we're gonna go walk. And I told my son, I said, that's a testament to you because you've set a tone for them that they can grieve, they can be sad, and then they can go eat ice cream. They're still living their lives as kids. That's because they know that their dad loves them. Yes, they have their aunties and their grandparents and everything, but you're setting the tone. You're setting the tone because you, in your grieving, are still there for them. You're loving on them. And they're watching TV together. They're all climbing on them and everything. And it just breaks my heart because here he is trying to move forward. He said he had a dream. One of his dreams, Olga came to him in his dream the other day, and she told him how proud she was of him. I said, son, I believe with all my heart that's what you saw, because she's watching you be the dad, even in this horrific situation here, and you're doing a phenomenal job. I told him, you may not feel like it, you may, because he's so heavy, right? There's so much that's going on. But Shai, she was amazing. She was absolutely amazing.
For who didn't know her.
Yeah.
What do they need to know to understand Olga?
Olga's like,
Olga was she worked with Stand With Us, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, she worked with Club Z.
Club Z.
That was an organization she was the CEO of for a while. Our dear friend Masha Makaluva. I always say Masha's name wrong. I'm sorry, Masha. She was doing Israel, Africa, and Black Jewish work for years. Again, she was doing it in South Africa. But she came to the States to get her MBA from Regent University. And my son, they knew each other already, but they began to have a relationship and everything. And that's how they got married, fell in love and everything. She's a force of nature. Olga spoke out about the anti-Semitism on the campuses there in South Africa. Close friend of the Jewish people. Received multiple awards for what she did. And like me, she got it internally. In other words, and she's much more gracious than I am. Olga would speak out and put everything on the line because she knew it was the right thing to do. As a matter of fact, her story is that when her dad started that organization, she was a very high-powered attorney, one of if not the most prestigious law firm in South Africa. So she had her career. She's just blazing trails. So when her dad came and said, I'm starting this organization, she's like, oh, well, you don't have time to do that. He started it because he heard the apartheid lie being spread all over the world. So when he got back home from travel, he goes, nope. Same thing. He's like, no, we experience it. Mm-mm. It's that same righteous indignation. He's like, hell no. We're going to start this. No, that's not apartheid. I've been to Israel multiple times. It's not an apartheid state. Well, her response to him, her own testimony was like, "Yeah, well, dad, that's cool, but you don't have time for that. Yeah, let other people do that." He says, no, I'm going to do this and you're going to help me. Right? So she starts helping him, but then it gets in her bloodstream. And boom, she's speaking all over the place. She's doing videos. She's doing work, Black Jewish relations, Africa, Israel. We took our first ambassadors group to South Africa. She helped plan the whole thing. We saw things that those young people would have never had seen. Had Olga not done it with the Jewish community, those who had fought against apartheid, Robben Island, those our young people, the IPSI ambassadors, never be the same. Olga was a force of nature and was our daughter. And so, yeah, it's a lot. So outpouring of love from the Jewish community literally around the world. We buried her body in Tel Regev in Haifa. My son, he didn't know at first after the first couple of days of her passing. He said, I think she should be buried in the Holy Land. And we said, okay, son, whatever you want to do, we want to help. He reached out a couple of friends. And Shai, the response that we got was that it got taken over. They heard about who Olga, they knew who she was, they knew our work, and just doors just flew open. The people wanted to help and do, and we weren't asking for help, we just wanted to find out what do we need to do, we know it's going to be very difficult. They gave her a complete Orthodox Jewish burial at this cemetery, and she's a Christian. They honored her in all these different ways. The president,
Herzog.
Yes, Herzog. He came to the house. We were sitting Shiva in our friend's house not too far outside of Jerusalem. He came personally to the house.
The president of Israel.
To express his condolences to the Meshwe and the Washington family. Again, as I said there on the day of the burial, Shai, and we've seen the graciousness of our Jewish friends for a long time, but we've never experienced it to that degree. I said there at the funeral and at the burial that when I discovered Dr. Martin Luther King Street in Jerusalem, like my friends told me about that, there's a forest planted in the honor of Coretta Scott King in the Upper Galilee. My Jewish friend said to me, Dumisani, the Jewish people never forget a friend. So that was years ago, right? So now my daughter-in-law passes away, and not only is she buried in Israel, but many Israelis came to the funeral. We're just overwhelmed. We said, here we are. You all are in the midst of a war. You still have hostages in Gaza. Up to that point, over 800 and some odd IDF had been killed since October 7th. But here in the midst of your mourning and grieving, you come here to hug us, to cry with us.
You're not an ally, you're a family.
It was just so overwhelming. It's just overwhelming, David. And so, Shai, I could not have ever imagined that. And again, Olga didn't do it for any of those, you know, nobody was expecting anything, right? Again, she did it because she knew it was the right thing to do. But the outpouring of love from the Jewish community here in the States, I was in Tojo's in San Diego. I was at a Hillel. I didn't speak there. Apparently, it was the largest group that had come, some hundred and something kids. And when we get done, one by one, they come, Pastor Washington, we want to express our condolences. We're so sorry to hear. I mean, these young kids in college, but they're aware of what had happened, and just wanted to, I just began to cry again, right? Again, this is what we have seen from our Jewish brothers and sisters. That's why for us, when we hear the demonization and everything, like, okay, nobody's perfect, but you guys have no idea what you're talking about when you're painting with a broad brush, who you believe Israelis are, who you believe American Jews are. You guys don't really, really understand. Many people do, right? We have many black friends who've had experience, not to the same degree, but their friendships with the Jewish community that go way, way back, right? Yeah. So, and we celebrate those things and we bring those things to bear now so that people understand, and these connections are still very, very deep and they're still very, very prevalent now. So,
yeah. Olga Mishwe Washington. Yeah. She was an important person.
Absolutely. We miss her dearly, but yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I'm sure you're doing her proud.
We're going to do our best, Shai. We are. We are. Yes,
so I'm going to end like I end always with the here I am lightning round. It's just a rapid question. There's no right or wrong answer. It's just whatever first comes to mind.
Okay.
Dumisani Washington, what is one thing people don't know about you?
I don't know about me. Is that my given name is not Dumisani, it's Dennis. I wrote that in my book. I did a name change back in the 90s. Yeah, and it's a Zulu name, which means praise.
What is one thing people don't know about the Black church?
They don't know the history of how it sustained us as a people. Much like our Jewish friends, that synagogue became a center of life in a sense in terms of communal, even if they were non-religious, there'd be this communal thing. This was true in terms of the Black church. We recognize historically that we were sustained and thrived because of our family, because of our connection together, and because of our love for the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's why we would sing those songs like we could sing them. Many people don't know that about the historic Black church, I should say.
I know you're a pastor, so you can skip this one. What is your favorite curse?
I'll pass on this one. I do have one, but I don't want to put it on the screen. I'll get in trouble. My wife will get mad at me. So
okay, yeah. I appreciate it. When was the last time you cried?
About yesterday. I'm thinking about Olga. This happens every once in a while. I sit there, something that happened, and just began to weep and everything. So yeah.
If you could be invited for Shabbat dinner with any Jewish person in history, dead or living,
boy, that's hard.
Who would that be?
Boy, that's really hard. I'm just gonna say Golda Meir, just because it's someone I would like to ask a few questions about everything. Yes, sir. Yeah.
What'd you ask her?
I would ask her about Mashab. I know what she's written about, what she did, the work. Golda Meir set the tone for what Israel does throughout Africa, throughout the continent, and I know some of what she said. But I would ask her some more questions about things. Tanzania, Ghana, all these different places, at the independence celebrations and everything. I'd ask her about I'd go deeper still. Why was this so important to you? And do you recognize how beloved you were among some of these African leaders because of that? It was the way that she did it. It wasn't in a high and mighty thing. It was a let's work together thing. And that resonated with many African leaders. It wasn't like we Israelis going to talk down to you Africans. And it was really a, come on, let's do this. Let's get our hands dirty. Let's do this together. A quick story, people don't know this. She's in Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe. And she was visiting there, and there was still apartheid in that region of the world. So she was visiting the African community there. And then the white government from the other bordering town said, we want you to come and visit. She said, no, thank you. The thing is, as long as you guys keep doing what you're doing, I don't want to look at that level of, you know, of chutzpah, right? So I would ask her a few questions about that, because she helped set a tone there on the continent in a way that we haven't really seen. Israel, Mashab against is her legacy, right? But I'd ask her some questions about how she started it and everything, yeah.
What is your favorite holiday?
I don't know if I have a favorite holiday. Hanukkah.
Right.
We do a lot of Jewish celebration stuff in the house. Yeah.
What is your least favorite holiday?
Oh boy, I'm gonna get into much trouble here.
It can be a secular holiday. Yeah, yeah, it can be a bank holiday.
Yeah, a bank holiday. I don't know. I don't know what my least favorite one is. I guess Halloween. I mean, not to disparage for other people, but I've never been. He's a little kid and Halloween. Yeah.
Me neither. actually, today's it's Purim. I'm not a fan. Yes. When do you feel safest?
At home, surrounded by my family.
When do you feel least safe?
I don't know. I guess if I'm out in what would be considered more hostile territory, right? It's been a while, but I'm in, you know, you're in a college campus situation and you don't know what might jump off, right? Oh.
That's a huge admonition in the U.S. society where you're not Jewish.
Yes.
And even you feel unsafe
you
can feel or can be unsafe in
absolutely.
Campus.
100%.
What gives you hope?
my kids and my grandkids. This is why more and more I do what I do, right? I believe that they will have a different reality to live. I believe that if we contend in the fight that we're doing now, they can enjoy more of a peace and of freedom, and that it's incumbent upon us to do it. So that's what gives me hope. When I see my grandkids, it reminds me why we're doing what we're doing.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in general. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
I'll say
your organization. You take donations as well. So your organization, I want to get the name right.
Okay, yes, sir.
It's the Israel.
Institute.
The Institute of Black Solidarity for Black Solidarity with Israel.
Yes, sir. Yes.
So I say donate to the Institute for Black. You say something else. Yes,
sir. There's a the reason I'm pausing is because my son and I were just talking about this. There is a Jewish-run school in South Africa that we visited. It is called, I'd have to get the name of it. So because we were encouraging people to give, they do amazing work, 5,000 plus students in one of the poorest parts of Johannesburg. And there's a rabbi who actually runs it. We took our ambassadors to it. I'm getting emotional as I'm talking about it now because I'm almost telling another part of the story. It's called, give me a second. Can you give me one second, please? Because I know this is not.
And I can also add it later. Yeah. Yes. Tell me about the and we'll find and add the names.
Yes, yeah. So, the school we went there. Tell me about the school, you mean? Yeah. The school, it has about like 5,000, probably maybe more than that. We went there in December of 22. And they have a sustainable garden because in the neighborhood there, it's very, very poor. So they help try to feed everybody in the area because they don't have any food. These kids perform above the standards in terms of their state level thing for South Africa, consistently in math and reading and everything. They are amazing, amazing students, which is a proof of just give the opportunity, right? They can excel and do, right? So it's a rabbi and other parts of the Jewish community that run it. We know about it from Olga. Olga's close friends with them, and so she introduced us to them and everything. And when we were there, quick story. We were there. He was showing us all around. And they weren't in session then because his kids were out for a while. So we had the run of the whole facility everywhere. And we were taking pictures. He says, you can take pictures, but don't tag it. Don't place it on social media. He says, because the BDS, there's what's called BDS South Africa, which is one of the most vicious BDS organizations on the planet. If they find out where we are, they'll come here and they'll burn this place to the ground. It crystallizes for these black young people that we just brought from here. Here's this hateful thing. It's not about freedom for the Palestinians. It's not about anything that they're calling justice. It's about hatred for Jews and then hatred for anybody standing with them. So here's a rabbi who's over this school that's doing amazing work, but he knows that the people who run the BDS South Africa, they will burn the place to the ground, meaning they won't have anything. They don't want any type of legacy of the Jewish people. And their legacy goes way back. Nelson Mandela himself thanked the Jewish community for their help during apartheid, for their help in building the nation, all of those things. They don't want any remembrance of those things. So when he said that, all of our students, our young people, they kind of looked and said, yeah, that's how real this is. That's what this fight is, right? Here, these people are doing amazing work for these black South Africans. And the people who hate Israel will burn it to the ground because they don't want anybody help. They don't care about these black South Africans. So that, and I can't remember the name, but it's something Hope, the name of it, because there's a name of the school. But we're urging people. So Olga's last memorial celebration will be tomorrow in Charlotte, North Carolina, where I live. I'm headed back there now. And that's one of the things we'll be telling everybody. If they want to make a donation contribution, please give to that school that's doing amazing work.
We'll make sure to note the name of the school. Yes, maybe I'll even record something.
Thank you, sir.
Dumisani, where can people find you?
IBSI.org is our organization. And then you can find that the different social media pages that are there at the bottom of IBSI.org. But some of my pages are connected too. So if you go to IBSI's Twitter page, you'll see it follows me. Their Instagram page and everything. So yes, I'm always running my mouth about something. And again, I tell people I do that on social media. What we do is in the real world, right? I'll say stuff on social media, but then we'll actually go do it in the streets, if you will. So yeah, they can follow me there. Dumisani Washington is the name there, and you'll see it on either one of those there.
I just want to note, because you're not looking at the clock. I'm looking at the clock, and I don't think you realize we've been talking for 2 hours.
I didn't know what it was.
It's been so much fun. It just ran like this. I am just really grateful that you made the trip to come here. I hope your voice is heard, not just all over the country, but all over the world. And I'm just delighted to say, here I am with Dumisani Washington.
Thank you, Shai. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."